afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Other Minds and Hands. This is episode number 66, and today we return. We talked about it a little bit last week at the beginning. Maggie and I are really excited to talk about Dune 2. This is such a fascinating example. I've said before that I don't find when an adaptation is a bad movie or even a bad adaptation, it's still really interesting to think about and talk about. It's not always the conversation I would prefer to have, but boy, is it fun to talk about an adaptation that is really, really good. Like, so I'm really looking forward to that. But of course, one of the things, today we're talking about Dune 2, and, I've been looking forward to the opportunity to kind of talk through some of this stuff a little bit more as I've had a little bit more time to process. I've still only seen it once, so that's my little caveat. I generally don't like talking about things I've only seen once, but
But I think we've already decided this is like our first conversation. So yeah. This is just going to be kind of like initial reactions. And then we'd like to bring on Trevor and Dom and maybe Amy Sturgis or something to talk about some of the deeper analysis and comparison stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. But Maggie, I'm really curious to talk about some of the adaptation decisions that they made. In particular, there are some sort of questions that I have. One of the major questions is about their handling of the Alia situation. In film as yet unborn sister situation. In my opinion, I certainly left the theater saying that was the most significant departure from the text. Like that was the decision that I was feeling most as far as the impact that it had on the story that they were telling.
How did it impact you? Like what feeling did you have that made it feel like a massive shift?
So there were, it was the root of some of, there were not, I was not feeling disappointed by very many things at the end of this film. But of the small number of things I was feeling disappointed by, this was the root of many of them. In particular, in my opinion, I often talk about cost, right? Like how much it costs to, like, what is the price of making a particular choice? You can get value out of it, or it can, you know, it can be fairly expensive, right? And to me, the cost of the decision to keep out Alia. And let me back up a second and say, let me just first make sure everybody knows what we're talking about, because not everybody has read Dune recently.
We didn't give it any introduction, did we?
No, we did not. So let me explain a little bit more about the situation here. So in the film, we have Jessica undergoes the Reverend Mother test with changing the waters of life. And she's pregnant, and they don't realize that is the Fremen Reverend Mothers don't realize that she's pregnant, and they would not have had her do, like, it's, you're not supposed to do this when you're pregnant. In the book, they make it explicit that if she had been pregnant with a male child, it would certainly have killed the male child. But it was a female child, and so the female child has her awakening at the same time that Jessica does, and the, like, fetal child in Jessica's womb already has, like, all of the memories and experiences of all of the, you know, Reverend Mothers that have come before her. And so in the book, there several years happen between when they get to the siege in the middle of the film, or what was the end of film one, basically. Well, I have to admit, I expected more of a jump of time at the beginning of film two. Like, I didn't expect them to still be walking home on that same day, essentially, at the beginning of the film. I expected them to jump ahead, frankly, jump ahead even to this time, the 2 years or whatever. But anyhow, Jessica and Paul live at the siege for years in the book, such that Paul and Chaney have a kid Who is then killed? Like, they cut the kid. That's another question. We'll talk about that elsewhere. The Paul and Chaney relationship and the changes they made with that. But Aaliyah is born and grows up to become an extremely creepy toddler, right? So, like, because she has already, like, generations worth of adult memories and understandings, when she's an infant, her physical apparatus is not capable of clear speech, but she can, you know, her like mind is fully developed and she has a, so she's like not only talking fluently as a babe in arms, but she's able to like, you know, make sexual innuendos and stuff
and
that
toddlers should
a one-year-old, two-year-old just should not do and should not know. And so she's this like weird, creepy, like devil child, essentially. Mm-hmm. And there is a huge sense of the other about Aaliyah, child Aaliyah. The kind of culmination of the Aaliyah plotline in Dune itself, she's the one who kills Baron Harkonnen at the end. And she stabs him with a poisoned needle while he's standing there amidst everybody. No one's really paying attention to Aaliyah. And she goes over and she creeps up next to him and she stabs him with a poisoned needle. And she delivers, it was one of my favorite lines in the book. She says, "Meet the Atreides, Gamjabar." And the Baron dies. So back to what I was saying about the cost. One of the costs of this, so they chose not to have the time pass. There are more implications to that, but I want to focus on Aaliyah for a second.
Yeah.
Leaving Aaliyah in the womb for the entirety of the end of the story removed this, how do I want to say, this external reminder of strangeness. Like there's an uncanny valley kind of experience of seeing Aaliyah, like someone who looks like a one-year-old but speaks like an adult, right? I mean, it's like, it's deeply, deeply strange, and everybody has a really strong reaction to it. And there is a way in which Aaliyah is like an external form of, reminder of the, like, the unnaturalness, the strangeness, right? Mm-hmm. Jessica has unnatural powers, but it's, like, normal in the Reverend Mother world and in the Bene Gesserit world. Like, there's a category for that, right? Paul is, you know, has visions and things and is straight, but he's, but the Fremen have a category for that too. He's a prophet, right? He's the Lizan al-Ghaib, right? Like that's the whole like drama, right? Is they have this bucket ready for him, right? And he fits in that bucket. The fact that he fits in that bucket too well and too comfortably is part of the drama, right? One of Aaliyah's roles that I see in the story is like nobody has a bucket for Aaliyah. Like there is no shelf that she rests on comfortably, right? And everybody is uncomfortable with her. In fact, again, it's to me one of the striking moments, one of the most striking moments of the confrontation at the end, when the Reverend Mother, the old Reverend Mother, the Emperor's Truthsayer, Helen Mohayim, who's there, right? And she's there in the film too. When she sees Aaliyah, she knows what Aaliyah can communicate telepathically with her. She can perceive like the Reverend Mother bond that she has with this like 2-year-old. Right. And she is horrified. She calls Aaliyah an abomination. And it's because of Aaliyah that she says to Jessica, she's like, "Jessica, what have you done? You have betrayed everything. Like this should never be." And so that kind of so again, good or ill, and I'm not saying that I think what they did in the film didn't work, but it's felt to me like a massively consequential decision to not have that. Because, I mean, you get some of the otherness, some of the, this is not normal, this is really, like, outside of everybody's definitions. Some of that is achieved by the communication with the fetus, right? Like, just Jessica being able to have telepathic conversations with the child still in her womb. You get some sense of the otherness there. But it's nothing like, I think, having a one-year-old toddling around, having fully adult conversations and like saying, being a part of the whole story in the way that Aaliyah is.
Well, I'm not going to have a quick answer for you, but I think we talked through some of the thoughts that could go around this, because I think it's really important to hear what was, and coming at it from a fresh brain that did not remember all of that Aaliyah stuff. Mm-hmm. I thought, wow, I've never seen anything like this on screen. Having that conversation between the mother and fetus, and having Paul be super aware, is she okay? What does she think? He is super aware that she is cognizant within his mother,
right.
Just tightens that circle.
Right.
So I found that really powerful, that it's not this external thing the world finds weird. It's this very internal, insular thing between the three of them.
Yes.
That is incredibly strong and powerful.
Yes.
That amplifies them.
Yes.
So to me, that was the reasoning behind it. Like, mm-hmm. if we're still visitors to this strange land and we're still taking in the visuals of this new dune and these new planets and all this cinematic wonder and awe that we have throughout, trying to get us to focus in on something that is really uncanny and really strange, that doesn't mean we're not going to see it. I mean, she's still a fetus at the end of this film. So
right.
I assume in Dune 3, which, by the way, isn't going to come out until 2028 or 2030.
Whoa.
It's a long time to wait.
Wow, 2030?
Yeah. I was like, my kid's going to be 8. I can't even, like, deal with that time.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was the first thing I Googled when I left the theater, was when is the next one coming out? And they said 28 or 30.
That's a remarkable amount of time.
So that means that we'll probably still get to see those super uncanny moments. I imagine they're going to play into that because it unnerved so many of the audience that they would want that to hit,
mm-hmm.
but not yet, because we're still digesting this new Paul, this new prophet Paul, this
yes.
new, you know, super powerful medicine woman type vibe, like all this other stuff. So maybe they just tried to pull that in. I did try to find some stuff of what the director Denis Villeneuve said about it, but the only thing I could find was that he did it to compress time and to put more pressure on Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Also wanted to create an interesting dynamic with Jessica to increase this idea that the Bene Gesserit have control over their genetics and control over their bodies.
Yes.
Okay, but that doesn't feel as deep to me as, like, keeping it that tight triangle really
yeah.
sucks in.
Yeah. It's just one of the many reasons why I don't take answers actors and directors give to the press as explanations of what's happening in a film.
And this is also from a press junket. So
right.
like, depending on who was interviewing him and who the next 15-minute slot went to, he might have had a different answer. We
right.
don't know.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Time compression we've talked about a lot. Like, Rings of Power, we talked about time compression a lot. And, like, that does make sense because we don't have the time to spend 2 to 3 years watching this toddler grow up and start to be weird and uncanny, because we need Paul to take action now.
Yes.
So those two timelines don't really make sense. Like, we can't have years of Paul just waiting around. Having Paul make that jump in a period of what we can assume is just a couple of months, because we watch the belly grow.
Yeah.
To being an unsure leader, a humble, you know, backseat driver, to being, I am in charge, I am this, you know, professed person. That to me is the really big arc. So if mm-hmm. if you need to show that, yes, that compression makes sense. The toddler is not the focus here. Paul is.
Yeah.
So maybe Aaliyah becomes more of the focus in the third one, but
yeah.
planting that seed with us.
Yeah.
That payoff in
yeah.
the third one.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I do see clearly keeping the focus on Paul. Right. And I will say that the way that they the way that they focus, the way that they focus all of the attention on Paul himself, the way that they shape the trajectory of Paul's discussion, I wonder, well, it does feel like it makes more sense. Cause I'm sort of thinking through a bunch of things at one time here. If Paul, let's talk a little bit about the story, the central story, which I think is the central story of this film, about Paul's leadership, right? Paul's relationship to the prophecies, Paul's relationship to the religious traditions of the Fremen, and Paul's visions about the jihad, about the coming war, that he does not want to cause.
If you were pushing me to choose a through line, there would be no hesitation with this one to say Paul.
Right.
Every action that happens in this one is about Paul.
Yes.
We're watching this unlikely hero, you know, step into that monomyth and, you know, take up the reins of a sandworm and mm-hmm. step into that role of becoming that leader. I'd be hard pressed to pick the through line for the first film. Not to say that it doesn't have one, it's so weak. It's like, no, like there's lots of storylines in that one that are being established that you could see quite a few different options available to that. Sorry, my camera keeps cutting out, but I'm still here. hotel Wi-Fi. Oh no.
Yeah.
So yeah, with the second one, it's so prominently Paul. I think that's why I loved it so much, because the clarity was so strong of this is our character, this is the arc we are watching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like
yeah.
you could diagram it.
Yeah, yeah. No, that was clearer. Though
like Brave Brown Bear in the chat on Twitch. He's the Duke's son, then a Fremen leader, then both the Fremen leader and the Duke. Like, right? Like pulling all those threads together, and none of them are wrong, none of them are like inauthentic. He is all those things.
Mm-hmm.
But then reinventing them into this new being that he's stepping into.
Yes. And the use of the visual symbol of the ducal signet and his putting away the ducal signet and taking it back out then at the end. And that was very well done. They did a good job of clearly kind of signaling that trajectory there. The moment that I think is still hardest for me to process, that is, I can make sense of it, but I'm least sure. This is where I'm least sure that I'm like necessarily picking up what they were putting down here, right? Is there is that moment, the moment in the film, which is a bit of a jarring transition. One moment, Paul is saying, I'm going to stay up in the north if I have to stay up here all by myself, because I know that if I go to the south, you know, this is going to happen. Like, you know, it's good. Like, events are going to snowball that are going to lead directly to the Holy War and the massacres and the destruction. So I'm not going to go. And Chani saying to him, you know, you should come, you should come. Right. I mean, like she was supportive of him, but she was urging him to come. Right. And then he goes down, he makes a decision to go. And then once he's down there, it's like, I'm all in all of a sudden.
Did he have, I can't remember the order now, because again, we've only seen it once. What was the impetus to get him to go south? I think it was drinking the water, right? There was some.
He does that when he goes south.
Wasn't that the reason he went south, was to drink the water? And then it was when he woke up from drinking that water that he was super changed.
Yes. And the drinking of the water and the... yeah, there are so many things that were kind of repurposed there. Again, it was another thing that I just, oh, there's so much to work through, because it was yet another example of, I'm sitting there thinking, on the one hand, like, as someone who has loved Dune for many years, I think this movie is really, really true to Dune, and they capture so many things from the book. But at the same time, even on my first view through, I'm like, they are making so many major changes. Like,
yeah.
This, you know, like anybody who just says like they're totally faithful to the book, I mean, holy cow. Yeah. And yet it's such a wonderful example of a marvelous adaptation, which does deliver so many things from the book. And yet they've made so many fundamental changes. It's just a marvelous illustration of that kind of thing. But anyway, I just keep stumbling over myself and thinking of all the different things to talk about. But
I think that's really worth listing, though, of like, this is why this is such a good one, because we're blown away by how good of a film it is.
Yes.
That you kind of forget the changes. That's what it should be, right? Like, mm-hmm. An adaptation should be such a well-told story that you forgive any shifts because it makes sense. But here we're like, wait, I want to try to remember what the shifts were.
Yeah.
And see why they might have made that decision.
Exactly. As I'm trying to work it through, because it seems to me, and I hadn't really thought, I was thinking about Aaliyah primarily when I was thinking about the time compression, right? But the other cost of the time compression. Sorry.
Okay.
The other cost of the time compression is the effect on Paul's process.
Yes. He's Paul, compressed.
Yes. Paul has, in the book, I would say, I think I would identify three stages of Paul's development into the Muad'Dib of legend, who does in fact kick off the Holy War, right? In the book, the turning points are there in the film. You remember the moment at the beginning of the end of the first film. Didn't we get at the end of the first film the scene with Paul and Jessica in the still tent? After their yep. copter crashes?
Yep. With the mouse yeah. on the edge and the...
That moment, which is the moment that he, like, comes to grips with the reality of the fact that his father's dead. And also, it's a really important moment for his visions, because he is, like, in the deep desert. He's surrounded by the desert. The spice is in the air. He's, like...
And super sensitive to it too, isn't he?
Yeah, it's the moment when he knows that Jessica's pregnant. You know, he foresees all of these things. So he starts having I would call that in the book the first turning point, right? In Paul's mind, up to that point, he has some notions, but he's all like, who am I and what do I have to do with this and what's going to happen? And it's all kind of uncertain. He has premonitions of things that are going to happen. Yes. But that's the moment where he's like, it's on. And in particular, what's on is he foresees clearly the jihad, the destruction, the thing that he wants to avert. And he talks about like seeing, you know, many paths that go in front of them, and down most of them is the jihad, with the Atreides banner, you know, being carried into, you know, atrocity after atrocity over a million worlds. And the second transition point, by the way, turning point is that when he takes the water of life, and that's near the very end. The period in between, that's the time lapse. That's when time happens, right? That's when he becomes, so like while he sees what's going to happen and he's trying to figure out like, how do I manage this, right? What futures that lie in front of me are necessary, and what futures are uncertain. What is in my control? What can I manipulate? And so he's always trying in that middle stage of the book. He's always trying to, like, can I divert the current of this, mm-hmm. you know, of this future, right? So his use of his name, for instance, he knows before he fights Jaimus, he's already had visions, and he, like, of them chanting the name Muad'Dib. Like, he knows his name is going to be Muad'Dib. He knows that Muad'Dib is the name under which, like, the jihad will happen. Yeah. So he makes a big deal of it, which I was wondering if they were going to do this, and they didn't really do this in the film. He makes a big deal about the fact, he's like, they're like, what is the name that you want to take? And he says, Muad'Dib. He asks about the mouse and everything. And, so, and then he says, Muad'Dib. And he says, wait, could instead of just being called Muad'Dib, could I be called Paul Muad'Dib? Because I don't want to leave behind the name that my father gave me. So instead of being Muad'Dib, I'm going to be Paul Muad'Dib. And so yeah, they're like, yes, you're Usul. Of course, he's Usul is his private name. And you will be Paul Muad'Dib. And he has that moment where he's like, so did I do it? Like, that wasn't in any of my visions. Like, they're not chanting Paul Muad'Dib in any of my visions. So have I introduced a change, right? Mm-hmm. Have I, in fact, managed to divert the flow? So the drama of the whole central section is all about the future that he foresees, right? Yeah. And how can he... So he's trying to manage it, right? He's trying to, like, this is going to happen. It's inescapable. We're going to be with the Fremen. You're going to become a Reverend Mother, Jessica. I'm going to become this leader. But can we organize things? Can we arrange things so that we don't lead it to that ultimate horrible destiny?
Right.
And how can I manage that? And then the turning point when he takes the waters of life, it's pretty, you know, like there's kind of only one thing that can happen after that. And he sees everything much more clearly at that point. But that's the point at which in the book, he kind of like gives up. Basically. And that's what gives the ending of the book. It's one of the things anyway, that gives the ending of the book. It's really unsatisfying nature is that ultimately it's a failure. I mean,
yeah.
It's, you know, it's this really complicated ending of the book where he wins, right? There's this awesome battle and he succeeds in the battle and he, you know, like seizes the power, right? And is going to make himself, forces the emperor to submit to him, marries Princess Irulan. And so he wins, right? Everything, the Harkonnens are destroyed and Paul wins and everything's happy, except it's not a happy ending, because his whole goal was not to survive. He knew he was going to survive. His whole goal was to prevent the jihad, was to stop that atrocious ending. And in the end, he just throws up his hands and he's like, it's going to come. It can't be stopped. And so he kind of gives into it. And I feel like that whole middle stretch, which is like it's like half the book almost, in which Paul is like trying to manage it and trying to divert it. I feel like that's what they compressed.
Okay.
And so what we get, so by the time Paul goes in the film, by the time he goes in to drink the waters of life, he's like done. Right. But just like two scenes ago up with I'm going to stay in the north all by myself if I have to. He's still resisting. So that middle stage of like, I got to figure things out. And they seem to like drop that out completely.
Between those two things, isn't that when they bombed their caves?
Yes, that's the thing that forces them to leave in the north. The rest of them are going back down. Yeah.
Because that just makes me think, because I remember that and being like, oh, well, that makes sense for him to move south. This is the thing that he needs to do anyway. His mother's already gone. He can't resist anymore, you know, just give in. But they've also bombed every resource you have, so you don't have anything here anymore. Like, why would you stay? Oh, wait, to stop this horrible war and famine. So that's the disconnect. Like, all the action makes sense for him to move south, but they didn't put enough import in your perception of like that element. Like clearly he doesn't want that to happen, but that didn't strike necessarily to me either as like being a real reason why he wouldn't go. Like he said there's many paths. He'll find one. You know, like, no, yeah. We don't seem all that concerned about this famine, horrible event yet.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And we should be, because that was, you know, a huge chunk of the book.
Yeah. 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 And so, and then overlaid onto this as well is one of the other major changes that they made. I think I would call this, this would be my number two most momentous changes that they made from the book in the film. And that was the introduction, not only of the sort of religious element of the, like, the Southern versus Northern Fremen cultural divide, right? That was, there's nothing of that in the book at all. There are no Northern Fremen in the book. That is to say that there's nobody who is resistant. There's nobody who doesn't believe. The Fremen all are like that. There's no... So the introduction of a prophecy slash Bene Gesserit slash superstition slash religious resistance movement within, like, the younger, especially the younger, it seemed, Fremen, but they locate it geographically, right? So that the majority of the Fremen are down in the south, and those who are down in the south are all zealots, right? And those in the north are not. That's not in the book at all. And so what's more, what that does is it, in the book, the relationship between Paul and the prophecies, right? The prophecies were seeded by the Bene Gesserit. Like, that's true. Like, that's legit. But see, the thing is that I feel like the book was introducing a level of irony that the film rejected. Here's what I mean. On Arrakis, there are prophecies of the Lisan al-Ghaib, who shall come, right? But people who are in the know, like Jessica and Paul, know that those prophecies and legends have been spread by the Bene Gesserit for their own political purposes, in order to help control the population. They do this in order to help control the populations of different planets, so that they place these religious traditions within particular planets, so that when a Bene Gesserit is in need, they can manipulate those in order to gain the support of the locals when that's necessary. Okay, so far so good. But the extra level of irony that the book introduces is basically the question of, like, on whom is the last laugh, actually, right? Yes, these prophecies were seeded by the Bene Gesserit, but they also actually come true, right? And Paul is doing, he is not just manipulating them, right? He sees, even in his own visions, that he is, like, the destined one who is destined to come. Like,
right.
Yes, the Bene Gesserit seeded the legends of the Mahdi and the Lisan al-Ghaib, but he is the messianic figure. Like, it's the irony, the joke, like, in the end, the joke's on the Bene Gesserit, because the very legends, like, that they seeded, yeah, it turns out to be truer even than they could know. And there's almost an implication, he never says this explicitly, but the implication is almost that the Bene Gesserit themselves were acting out, like, in seeding those prophecies in the first place. They believe themselves to be the puppet masters, right? But they themselves are only the instruments of destiny, right?
Right.
And that it so it turns out that the legends of the Messiah figure on Dune are only a result of the political manipulations of the Bene Gesserit. But it turns out that the political manipulations of the Bene Gesserit are themselves only a tool of the larger destiny and prophecy that's at work here. And that level... of irony, the film seems to have rejected, I think. I mean, it seems to me that it pretty much rejected those.
I say, think of the levels of essays we could write on free will and fate and things like that.
Yes.
Like this. And it's probably, I mean, one of those things that is just more difficult to get accomplished in a film. And I'm not using that as an easy out. It's more like you have to pick and choose what you're going to do. And that level of nuance is probably best directed in the long text, because you've got so much time
yes.
to understand these little winks and these little asides and these little, you know, things that create ironies to read between those lines. You have to be a little bit more explicit in filmmaking, that the subtleties still need to be clear, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. being able to bring that kind of nuance to
it is
something so complicated, you know, something yeah. so ingrained in these really complicated and sophisticated cultures. And we're not just talking about one simple nuance. There's yes. layer on layer here. So removing that and just having it be a vision of the decisions.
Yes, exactly.
It lessens the impact of the decision, right? Like, it just becomes a bit colder. I yes. guess I have to move south. My house was bombed.
Right, right.
You know, as opposed to all the nuance that we know is potentially within that. But that's what has to happen to move action forward. So that's a loss that is made. However, on screen, I don't think it was that jarring. Like, I think there's moments that you clock that, especially if you're a text fan, you're going to clock there's a separation there.
Yes.
But if you're not, you know, as I mean, it's been a couple of years since I've read Dune. So, you know, it wasn't fresh in my mind of what exactly was missing. I didn't really miss that. Mm-hmm. That part felt, there were like so few parts that felt jolting.
Yes.
That was one of them, just because it did feel too compressed. That yes. that shift of Paul's arc that I was so invested in, like, I am 100% here for every step of Paul's journey.
Yes.
But that part went too fast. It's like you just skipped a few
yes.
stairs. Yeah, there was that bit, and any scene with Willem Dafoe in it, I really struggled with.
Mm.
But that's my own personal
Wait.
Issue, I think, with the casting.
Willem Dafoe.
Emperor.
Oh, right.
And there's a third thing. What are your thoughts on Chani?
Okay.
Because I love Chani.
Yes.
And I felt like it was written by a man, and I hate that cop-out phrase, but it just didn't feel like there was the depth to the character that we're getting from the other characters.
So
much more sophistication, I thought, in the arcs, even of Florence Pugh, I forget her name, the princess. The
Irulan.
Yeah. Even her arc, she's brand new, and she feels way more yeah. gravitas. Okay.
So, here was my thoughts about Chani. The distance between Paul and Chani, especially at the end of the story, mm-hmm. is my number three biggest change from the most impactful change from the book. But it's directly related to number two. And that is, okay, and I have a suspicion that my reading of what's going on with Chani also helps to explain why you were feeling that disconnect with her. That's my theory. And it's because I think that what is the biggest challenge of adapting Dune, the book, is that in the book, you spent, goodness, good grief. Like, there are point of view characters and then there are point of view characters, right? We spend like 2/3 of the novel of Dune literally inside Paul's head. Not seeing what he sees and hearing what he hears, but with his thoughts and his introspection and his foretellings of the future and is thinking about the foretellings of the future. We get page after paragraph after paragraph and page after page of Paul thinking in this book, right? Us being carried along with what's going on inside Paul's head is like the most of what this book is in a lot of ways. Certainly many of the really crucial things happen definitely in. Definitely in Paul's head. And as you say, like, as you've said many times before, that's exactly one of the things that's hardest to do on film. Like, that does not translate real well, right? If you really, really wanted to give the experience, right? If you wanted to bring the film viewer along the same kind of journey that the book reader gets, you would have to have a Timothy Chalamet voiceover that we're hearing for two thirds of the whole film, basically.
Which is not the most interesting thing.
No, no. Which, and I do, so I do not in any way criticize them for not doing that. But, yeah. But if not that, then what? Like, how can we get? How do you do what that goes on in Paul's head, which is not hard to do in a novel, but real hard to do on film, right? So, my reading of Chani. At the end. I see people.
I know. I'm looking at this too. Mixed them up. Sorry.
Yeah. Yep. Christopher Walken. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. Right. Christopher Walken, not Willem Dafoe.
Willem Dafoe, he was the one who did the Green Goblin in the old original Spider-Man movie with Tobey Maguire, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. I just recently rewatched that film, actually. So I was just thinking, I'm like,
let's just note that Spider-Man would be a really fun one to talk about.
Spider-Man would be a fun one to talk about.
Have you watched the new Into the Spider-Verse, the animated one?
I haven't yet. That's on my list. I'm actually building up to that. That's why I went back and watched I'm doing what I do, which is like the completionist thing, right? I'm like, I think I want to watch some of that Spider-Man stuff. So I know what to do. I'm going to go back to Tobey Maguire and watch everything from the start. So,
It's going to pay off. Promise me. You'll be glad you did that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it'll be good. Also, I was going to watch the other one, the MCU one, the third film, the one where they do all the complicated...
Homecoming? No, Into the Spider-Verse.
Homecoming. But it's not Homecoming. It's not
Homecoming.
Far From Home?
No Way Home. No Way Home.
No Way Home. That's the one. Yeah, No Way Home. Anyway, I was going to watch that. So I'm like, okay, I can't watch that without going back and rewatching everything else. So anyway, that's why I saw that. That's why Willem Dafoe is in my head. Anyway,
Dafoe, Walken, separate. Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
Chani.
Paul, they're not going to put us in Paul's head in the film in the same way they do in the book. Paul has, like, there are two things always kind of at war. Paul acknowledges the inevitability of fulfilling the destiny, like walking the path of what's going to come. He's trying to manage it. He's trying to control it. A huge element, a huge dynamic of his character and his drama throughout the book is like, but I don't want to let this happen. I don't want the jihad to come. I am resistant to this stuff, right? And it felt to me very much that in the film, they took that resistance and they gave it to Chani, basically. So that by having this split, having her be resistant to him from the water of life forward, increasingly divergent, increasingly resistant to him. They basically displaced his own discomfort, his own rejection, right, of that future, of that route, and gave it to her instead, because he's not going to give us like Paul's internal divided mind, right? So we see Paul acting out the path, right? From the waters of life forward, we see him acting out the path, right? Him submitting to that future, right? But we still see in Chani his resistance. In the film, it's not his resistance. The film gives his resistance to her.
To Chani.
Right. And that's why I wonder if it helps to explain why you felt she was a character you could connect with much less, because I feel like in the end she plays an important role, but she very much ceases to be a separate person in my mind and becomes a representative of an idea. She becomes her whole character at that point, from the waters of life forward, becomes I am the embodiment of the resistance to Paul's destiny, right? To this, to embracing this future. And so it does kind of flatten out her own relationship with Paul and everything else.
I'm not a fan of that.
Yeah.
I've got some notes, producers. It's reminding me of, I don't know if we've ever talked about it, but Wakanda Forever, after the lead actor passed away and his sister took over the role of Black Panther. And right. I thought the film was great, but she didn't have nearly enough to do. She wasn't a leading lady, you know, and it's because she was really just filling the space and playing a revenge character in a set, you know. She didn't get her own story because she was just embodying this other one.
Yes.
And it's a shame because we don't have a ton of women on this screen, and Chani's a really incredible character, and we have some really cool opportunities there. So embodying something that is really important, I can get behind that. We need that. Yeah. But at the loss of a really cool character.
And I do... My fourth thing on my list was Jessica and her political machinations, like against Paul, sort of against Paul. I mean, and supporting him in one sense, but working against him in a different sense. That was very different from.
She was very antagonistic of him a lot.
Yes, very antagonistic.
Especially post Water of Life. So I mean, I assume we're supposed to see Water of Life maybe all revealing, but it's clearly really powerful and negative potentially and corruptive and things like that. And sure, I saw that, but it did corrupt those relationships that we spent so long developing, especially when we were just talking about the trio, like, you know, the fetus and Paul and Jessica, like the bond that they had, understanding each other, saving each other, working together to succeed and become part of the Fremen and respected and honored. And then to have that pulled apart, it hurts and I don't really like it. Mm-hmm. But as I was talking through that, I was also like, oh, that totally fits the arc of a trilogy. So here we are at the end of film two with a separation. You know, think of the Fellowship. They're all in different places. They're all disjointed. So when we have that kind of coming back together, it pays off that much more.
Wait a second. There are going to be three total films?
I think so.
No, I mean, like, it's done after the third film?
Oh, well, TBD.
Okay.
He said, they could be in this world for a while, is what I understand.
No, I mean, that they're going to go on, I think, what I thought was clear.
Somebody correct me if you've heard something else. What I heard is that there's a trilogy. So, like, we're going to have a complete thing. But then there is the potential for continuation if the story wanted to continue.
Okay, so, all right. Wow. Huh. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Okay, everybody's saying, there's only going to be three.
That's, I had not heard that. That's really fascinating. I wonder. Well, okay.
The director will not go beyond three Dune films, he told Time.
Okay.
And that was about a month ago.
Yeah. So he's going to. Okay.
Fascinating. Dune Messiah will be the last Dune film for me.
Okay. Cool.
But it also says this will end Villeneuve's Dune saga, so that could open it up for additional directors.
Right. Yeah. Sure. But that's fine. That's just like I'm just reorienting my own ideas especially if that's the way he's thinking. That does change. That changes a lot about my sense of the trajectory of the end of the film. But I do think, coming back to what you were saying before, one of the consequences of both, so Jessica and Chani's characters both become sort of connected to ideas, right? They both become kind of like, and I feel that both of them, we lose the sense of their own story, right? Of their own personalities, of their own, I don't know. Like, but the reason that I'm kind of adjusting about my ideas is, you're right. I had not been thinking in terms of the shape of a trilogy and of what it suggests about how these things could come together, because I thought this was two out of potentially six or eight films.
Oh, right? Yeah. Well, and I knew it was a trilogy, but it wasn't until I started saying to you, like, oh, I didn't like how this separated them, and that, oh.
Right. Wait a second. That's kind of what happens in film two of a trilogy. Yeah.
What they're trying to do. I get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Hickey Baby. Okay. Let's see. I would say, so let me respond to a couple of your questions there, Hickey Baby. First, yes, that it changes my ideas about that in a good way. Because I had a sense of the indefinite future for, you know, the Duneverse here in these films. And I was assuming that if we were moving forward past Dune, we were going to move on, you know, through Messiah, Children, and onwards. So, therefore, I didn't have any sense of... when you've got a planned trilogy of films, what the third film can and should do as far as bringing everything together is absolutely crucial, right? This is why, of course, in my own experience, my most dramatic personal experience of this was the Hobbit trilogy, right? Many of you have been around with me long enough to remember this, that I was still absolutely willing to give the Hobbit trilogy the benefit of the doubt. There were still lots of things I didn't love about the first two films, but I was totally willing to give it the benefit of the doubt, because the third film, like, there were opportunities for them to bring things back together. Like, there are some things that could have been recovered. And I had questions. I had plans. I had things I wanted to say. I'm like, okay, this could still be salvaged if they do these things, right? If these things can kind of come together in this way. None of them happened. Not a single one of the things that I was hoping would happen.
But it could have up to the last minute.
And that's why it wasn't until the third film came out that I was like, okay, yes, it's official. The Hobbit movies are quite bad, right? Because although there was a lot I didn't like about them, it could still have come together. So there are a lot of things that can, and I can't think of an example of this. But it's also possible to go the other way. I mean, it's also possible for the first two films of a trilogy to be really, really good and really promising. And then the third film comes and fails in a way which not only makes it a bad film, but undermines the films that came before. I can't think of any clear examples of this.
Mighty Ducks is the only one that came to my mind, and that's not really here. But I'm like, no, the third one of that was definitely the worst. Home Alone, third one was definitely the worst. Also bad examples, because that is not a trilogy.
Right, right, those are sequels.
Separate films.
Yeah.
Those are sequels.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So shelve that 14-year-old movie.
Yeah. But anyway, I am... So it does... My hope is that... So again, Maggie, thinking about the criticism that you were just making about Chani's character and kind of losing touch with Chani's character in the last half of that film. I have hope that it will return, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that could be done in a third film to make that work. Of course, another major change, and this wasn't on my list so much as it's a subset of, you know, the time compression thing. Paul and Chani have a kid in the book. That's kind of a big deal.
Kind of a big deal.
They have a kid and the kid is murdered. Like, it's a big deal. We almost never see the kid. I don't think we ever do see the kid. We hear about the kid, but I mean, he's a baby. He's still a baby when he's murdered, but and he's named Leto after Paul's father. Anyway, so like, are they going to go there? Like, what's going to happen? You know,
and just in terms of character development too, like, I might not be giving Chani the fair shake of it either, because we only meet her at the very end of the first film. So we haven't had time really. Mm-hmm. So if we haven't had time to get to know her, and the main focus of her character is now to embody this kind of ethereal element of Paul's life that isn't shown on screen, then that's a tough ride for her. We do get a lot of lovely intimacy moments that I think is important for them. And we see how distant, detached, and protective she is early on and immediately. Mm-hmm. And then to see the passage of time like that, and to see them waking up in the tent together and her comforting him about the dreams and saying, it's been a long time since you've had these. What a gentle, intimate way to show us the passage of time.
Yes.
You know, they're comfortable together in a tent, and it's been a long time since you've had a nightmare. So we've been through this before. We've talked about your nightmares, and it's been a while. That's a lovely way to kind of give us that level of their relationship. So I think that is also why it jars so much when it changes so quickly.
Yes.
Like, we could accept the gentle introduction of intimacy, but the violent removal of it is a little bit harder to
and it changed,
because it wasn't as well.
Yeah. It changed without a clearly precipitating event.
Yeah.
As far as their relationship was concerned.
Besides Water of Life. It's like he took the Water of Life and saw everything super clearly and had to be a jerk about it. You know, like he took that and was like, I see my path. I have to do this. Well, that's fine. But, you know, and he did have that one tender moment, like, excuse me, I'll live with you for as long as I live. And then immediately announces his betrothal.
Yes. Yes. So the last line of the book is Jessica speaking to Chani. One concubine to another, basically. And the last line of the book is Jessica saying to Chani that history will remember them as wives. There was a moment or two when I was wondering if we were going to get that line in the film, but then Chani went in a completely different direction. Right. I'm going to have to wait and see on Chani and the Chani question in particular. My thought was focused. So I wasn't really thinking about her as a character at the end so much as I was, because I was thinking about, I was kind of taking in the idea that she was representing, you know, and I was really interested in how she was being put forward as this representative and spokesperson for the resistance to Paul's mission. That she's connected with him. Right. Like, if they had just put that in some other Fremen, right, like a minority voice who was like, I'm uncomfortable with the Lisan al-Gaib thing. Right. Like, it wouldn't have been there. But since the two of them were bonded together, again, it was more like she was kind of representing an idea even that was within him. Right.
Yeah.
That she's almost speaking for him himself, a part of him anyway, when she's resisting it. And that you could, there's a sense in which you could almost say that Paul's character gets split at the end. Right. And the one that goes on to Imperial, there's like the part of Paul that goes on to Imperial power. And then there's the part of Paul that stays in the desert. Right. And stays true.
And that's like duty and self. Right. You know, there's the part that he's taking up saying, this is my fate. This is my duty. But here's where my heart is.
Yeah. And so I was so interested in how the film was handling that dynamic within Paul and within Paul's story. That I wasn't really thinking through the thing that you were more sensitive to of like, oh, so, Chani, now just a projection of part of Paul, I guess, you know,
I just missed her, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I really like Chani because, you know, again, like formative texts, like you, there just aren't that many wonderful women in these texts to latch onto. And so when you find one, you're like, yes.
Yeah.
And not that she was terrible in the film. I still loved her. I just
No, missed... and frankly, she's a very minor character in the book. We never get to know her personality really much at all in the book. We got to know her much more in this film than we do in the book, I think. So... but of course, that kind of makes us miss it more when we kind of lose it at the end.
When right? it's not quite there, yeah.
And to some extent, I think my defense, if I had to make a defense of this, what I would say is that sense of loss that you're feeling is perhaps part of the point, right?
Yeah.
That like we feel the loss, right? We become, as viewers, we become distanced from Chani. We no longer see what she is feeling and think. Like, we don't get her personality anymore because we, as viewers, are following along. Paul is our through line, right? We're following in Paul's story, and there's Chani further and further away and eventually going off into the distance. And we've lost her. Paul's lost her. We've lost her, too, right? And so the way in which they kind of mirror that is effective, I think, in that way. But it's hard still.
And I think it also accomplishes what they probably needed to accomplish, because we're human. We have emotions and empathy. And Paul just lost his home planet, which was stunning. And now he's on this horrible desert with no water. And then his home got destroyed. And then his father got killed. And then his doctor, you know, betrayed him. Like, all these things are piled up against him. And he finds compassion and comfort and understanding and support and acceptance from this woman, that of course we want him to stay there. Like, that is where your heart goes. Like, please be comfortable with this person. But that would be a very boring story if it just ended with comfort. So having that kind of breath of a moment to have a human connection as an audience to our character, who otherwise is a messiah character, is completely unrelatable in theory.
Yeah.
So having this really human moment for us to slow down and spend time with them becoming close makes that separation and him stepping into that other role where he does become this otherworldly thing that much more powerful. But it's almost our own little betrayal. There's there's something really strong there that I think is a really good hook to get the audience in.
Yes. I thought that was all of that was really, really well done. It was clear to me that, like, I want to be careful because this borders on the kind of critfic that I dislike, of like just getting into, because of what they did, I can tell what they were thinking, which is
always, is a safe space, but let's say I can see how that one could interpret. Right.
I could see how one could interpret. I'm going back now to the division between the Northern and Southern Fremen, the way in which they gave the skepticism and resistance to prophecy and religious fanaticism such a prominent voice in the film, when it has no voice functionally in the book, certainly among the Fremen. I can see how one would wonder. It feels like there's a challenge. There is a perceived challenge in a modern audience here. I'm going back to something Higgy Baby said earlier on, that that Chani becomes a kind of proxy for the audience in our resistance, which we presumably feel. Like, on the one hand, the scene where Paul declares himself the Lisan al-Ghaib is really powerful. Like, that is just a marvelously well-done scene.
The way that was shot, too, was just...
It's so gorgeous. Visuals.
Yeah, incredible lighting, incredible use of space and people and scope. Oh, that was really cool.
Yeah. And so anyway, that was an amazing scene. But of course, at the same time, like, it's deeply uncomfortable. Seeing seeing Paul be declared the Messiah by, you know, the swarms and swarms of zealots is is very uncomfortable. Like many people in a modern audience, for lots of different reasons, are going to be deeply uncomfortable with that. And so the film seems to have taken steps to sort of manage. Like, I think it's in this respect not surprising that if the Fremen had been depicted as universally devoted to that kind of religious zealotry as they're depicted in the book, I think that people would have felt that it was just like an enormous slight on them as a people, you know. I don't know. It introduced a dynamic, an element that just wasn't there in the book at all, and did seem to me to be primarily the function of it seemed to me primarily to be audience management. Like, if we didn't have Chani and her other young female friends speaking skeptically of the prophecies, like, if they didn't say it out loud, the audience would be thinking it anyway. And that the pressure of that, like the pressure of watching everybody accept this while the audience is thinking, that's ridiculous, that's just superstition, this, I can't respect this at all, right? Could create a tension. So by just like putting it out there, by like giving that a voice in the film, it is a, where it's, you know, it addresses it specifically in a way that the film just doesn't really address it.
Creates that tension.
And yes, Jessica fully embracing Paul's, well, she doesn't exactly fully embrace Paul's destiny. She believes that manipulating them in this way is the way to secure Paul and the Atreides' future. In one sense, they're playing off of an idea that is very important in the book, and that is Jessica as like proxy for the Bene Gesserit, basically. Jessica thinks she's in control of the situation, right? She thinks that she is manipulating things for the greater good. That the foothold she has established by becoming the Reverend Mother among the Fremen and securing Paul's place and therefore the Atreides' future, that she's won, right? That she is, like...
fulfilled the task.
Yeah, she's managing things properly and bringing about the ending that she wants. And throughout the book, through especially the second half of the book, there's this pressure between her and Paul that says, look, no, like, you don't have any idea what you're doing. Like, you think you're in charge of things. You're being swept along in the same way that everybody else is. It's the way Paul's, the distance between Paul and Jessica in the book, that's kind of how I was talking about that extra level of irony, right? Where the Bene Gesserit think they're manipulating everything and are in charge. And in fact, perhaps they're being pawns themselves, right? It's primarily, I think, through the gap between Paul and Jessica that we are introduced to that idea. He sees that she thinks she's in control, and he's like, you have no idea that everything you do is just part of this, you know, current towards this future, you know, that that we can't stop. Anyway, so it was a pretty large change in some ways. I didn't love the way you said before, antagonistic. Like, I felt like there was a more antagonistic relationship between Jessica and Paul. And
especially the second half, yeah,
in the second half. And I agree that sort of flavor of it is not really, that's a fairly significant shift from the book. And in some ways, I think becomes a kind of channel. I didn't think of this before, but maybe it becomes another way to kind of help us cope with the discomfort of the zealotry, right? Because we know, basically we can blame Jessica for it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
She has stirred it up. Like, it's this. Mm-hmm. It's not just that these people spontaneously react this way. They've been manipulated into acting this way by Jessica.
She, like, paid for the ads, you know? Like, she was the creator and the funder and the
yes. Yes. So it's in some sense, their response, by putting her in that role, the film almost scapegoats her, so that when we see all of the Fremen responding, we don't just look at this and say, what a like sad group of idiots following after, right. You know, following. Instead, we see like, they're almost like the victims, like they've been manipulated.
Yeah.
Right.
And you can understand how easily it would happen, because it's in every box, like, he is fulfilling every criteria.
Yes.
That's required.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
I feel like we've barely scratched the surface here.
And
we haven't talked about half the characters, and we haven't talked about, there's so many shots that I feel like I'm going to use stills from this film for the rest of my film class teaching career.
Yes.
Like the black and white used in the
on Gaiety
the
Prime. Yeah, on the Harkonnen planet.
Backlit sequence. Oh my word. There's so many things. Okay, so we'll put a pin in that for future analysis. Because also just like how that tells a story. Like taking color out of that perception, like, just it immediately just gives us, there is only black and white, there are only these two ways for us to function, and the way that kind of subconsciously gets into your brain when you're watching that film, like, there is no gray space in this planet, can you tell?
right yeah. I admit, so this isn't necessarily, this might be more of a story about me than a story about this part of the film. It took me a long time to notice that it was in black and white. It didn't strike me like, and in retrospect, I was astounded by that. Right. Like I was receiving a different kind of visual effect I was aware of. But at first I thought or felt that it was just like makeup that they, anyway, I can't imagine a film. I would never have imagined that a film could shift from color to black and white in the middle and it not feel jarring. And me not have that moment of like, whoa, why do we switch to black and white? Like, it was, I was just like, yeah, I mean, everyone was like, that everything was black and white. I knew, I could tell. But anyway, it was just, it was remarkable. Like the way, the rightness of that, the way that it just, I did not question what I was seeing.
And that's the difference. You know, I mean, that's the world building. We're like, you know, this is a personal thing, but like when I was in Iceland, I was taking pictures, and it was only later that I was looking at my photos that I thought I had put a black and white filter on it. There was no color. It was just snow and rocks. So everything was black and white. And it was just surreal, but in the moment it was very fitting because that's the world that I was in.
Yes.
So when you see that on screen, it was such a stark contrast from Arrakis. We didn't question at all that it was like devoid of color. It was it was right because it was different, right? Like there's something really powerful in that just because it's separate, it fits this world, and that is enough of a separation. It's not because it's devoid of color, it's just that's the color it is.
Yeah. And the way that it fit with, especially since that was essentially the introduction of Fade Rautha's character, right? And like the utter hairlessness of Fade Rautha was so creepy. Like the super close-ups of his face, I was like having an uncanny valley experience. Like it was,
and the lack of eyebrows.
Yes.
And almost black.
Completely. Yeah. Yes. I was, it was amazing. And it's part of what made the black and white feel correct. You know, just like, you know, I didn't even question it. Right. I didn't even notice it in a sense. Anyway, but this is just to say, I agree with you. There were so many things that were done in this film that were so remarkable. And there were so many things, and gosh, I would love to talk about this too. Okay, here's high on my list of things that I would like to talk about, but we don't have time yet. Maybe we can talk about this with Dom and Trevor and at some point. But the end, the final battle, was mm-hmm. so well done. On the one hand, it fit every. My first reaction was, I was like, that is exactly how I've always wanted to see the Battle of Arrakeen played out. Like, the sandworms coming through the gap was like the greatest cavalry charge of all time, yeah. right? Yeah. It was incredible. But
and for that to have not have been laughter inducing, right? Like, it actually paid off. That wasn't funny.
It was amazing.
That was incredible. Yeah, yes. And it would have been so easy for worms to be hysterical at that moment.
Yes, yes, exactly. But
but
there's a cost. The cost is, it's another significant change from the book. The battle is not depicted in the book. We're just told about it. And let me say, I always hate that about the book. I always pine for the battle, the satisfaction of the battle, of the victorious battle at the end of the book. But we don't get it, really. And we know that it happens. We're told what happens. But we don't get exactly what the book does not give us is that sweeping, triumphant crescendo at the end. I haven't really fully thought through, what are the consequences of actually giving it to us? Mm-hmm. What are that there are benefits I as perceiving. I was enjoying it very much. It felt very satisfying. But that in itself, I was not feeling guilty about it, but I was very conscious of it, self-conscious of it, because I'm like, I feel satisfied in a way that I never do feel satisfied at the end of Dune. And I think that dissatisfaction is an important part of the end of the book. Yeah. Now, we did get some of the dissatisfaction later in the in the end of the film. It's not like they abandoned that entirely, but yeah.
No, but again, if you're thinking second of a trilogy, we need that. That has to carry us through. And, you know, the end of Two Towers wasn't exact to what we saw either, but there has to be some sort of a restructure to make sure the momentum carries.
Yep.
Because if you have a dull end to the second one, you might not get a third.
Yes.
Allegiant.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it's that also is something which, thinking of this as the second film of the film trilogy, does kind of change my thinking about a little bit. Because it's not the end of the story, even in the way in which the end of the book is the end of the book is not really, it's not a satisfying end. But it's also not exactly you've come to the end of the first book in the series. Stay tuned for as the story continues. The end of Dune never felt that way to me. I had read Dune for years before I knew there were other books, actually. But anyway, we are out of time, unfortunately. As you say, there's so much more that we could talk about, and fortunately, we will. So we're not gonna spend like dozens and dozens of episodes talking about Dune, but
it's rare that you get an adaptation that leaves you this satisfied.
Yes,
with this many changes in it.
Yes, like,
this is a really good case study for adaptation.
I also it just really realized
how much lens flares on me in this hotel room, but I just feel like we don't really get to talk about that this often, especially here where mm-hmm. we're talking about analysis. So it's lovely to have a case study.
Yes,
that I hope we can keep coming back to. So like, you've got time to watch and rewatch and rewatch this, but I feel like it's a good baseline example for us to refer to, like, oh yeah, we're talking about trilogies again. Remember this part in Dune? That's how they did this.
Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm.
It just feels like it's going to be a really good example for a long time.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, exactly. All right. Very good. Well, thanks everybody for joining us. We should be back again next week. So see you then. We'll see. We'll have it'll be another one of our Where's Maggie moments.
I'm at home.
You'll be home next week.
Okay. Yeah. And then I think I'm in the US. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Who knows?
I think next week's at home and then New Hampshire.
Woo-hoo. Excellent. Very cool. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. And we will see you guys again soon. Bye now.
Take care.